for the appellant, Mr. Carr.
Good morning, Your Honor. Opposing counsel, may it please the Court. I intend to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal with the Court's
leave. And introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Jason Carr. I'm counsel for the appellant, Garen Green. Mr. Green's trial is laden, interspaced, basically riven with numerous instances of evidentiary and constitutional error as well as prosecutorial misconduct. His conviction is constitutionally infirm and it should be reversed. To support that allegation, I will begin, or that assertion, I'll begin at the end, so to speak, with the government's closing argument. The closing argument contains definitive instances of prosecutorial vouching. It begins on page 404 of the excerpts of record, with the government using first-person singular pronoun I to describe his personal impressions of whether witnesses were truthful or lying and whether or not they were credible. Prosecution claims that our witnesses, in his personal opinion, were not credible, but that his witnesses were credible. And just as an example, he says at the bottom of page 404, talking about Gloria Green, one of his key witnesses, she got up on this stand and told you the truth.
Was there objection made at the time?
Your Honor, there's no objections to any of the vouching. It is reviewed for plain error. I will concede that at this point. But it is patent.
But as vouching goes, we've seen a lot worse, haven't we, that we've sustained?
Incorrect, Your Honor. I would point to the case United States versus Combs, a recent Ninth Circuit opinion that came down this year, which has vouching remarkably similar to the vouching that occurs in this case, particularly if we look at the vouching that occurs at the beginning of the government's reply argument on page 421, where the government sets up this dynamic of whether these individuals, to believe the defense and to acquit my client, you have to believe that these individuals, the police officers, came in here and lied to everybody, including the prosecutor, and it's a big conspiracy theory. He goes into the same dynamic about Gloria Green, saying that she had to come to this courtroom, lied to this court, lied to me, being the prosecutor, to the other attorney and the agent, lied to you all. That's remarkably similar to the vouching that occurred in United States versus Combs, which this court held was indeed prosecutorial vouching and reversed that case under a plain error standard of review. And I will note that what Combs also establishes.
Do I understand you say that if the prosecutor says the defense witnesses were lying, that is vouching?
If he says, I believe they were lying, yes, that is vouching, and I understand it's a high standard for the prosecutor to live under. And prosecutors are under serious constraints when they argue. They cannot use colloquialisms that common people can use. Indeed, they can't even use the same language that the defense attorney can use. And why is that? Because they are painted with the imprimatur of the government. They stand up there as a representative of the full force and might of the United States government. The jury understands that. They give the prosecutorial, they give the prosecutor the benefit of the doubt, a lot of credibility. When a prosecution makes personal assurances using that pronoun, first person, singular pronoun, that has been condemned by numerous decisions as improper, including Combs. It happens here not once, but many times. I direct the court's attention to 404, 405, the excerpts of record, 408, the 409, and 421, the 422. This is a case where even the government's answering brief, if we look at page 36 of the government's answering brief, they admit, tell this court, this case essentially reduces to whether Mr. or Mrs. Green was lying to the jury. Credibility of these two witnesses absolutely paramount to this conviction, to the government's case and evidence. The government vouched for Mrs. Green and denigrated Mr. Green using their personal opinion. They vouched for their witness and destroyed our witness's credibility using personal opinion. Case law establishes that that is error. The only question is whether it should be reversed. Well, how do we evaluate whether or not this error affected his substantial rights? Well, let's talk about some of the other error that occurred in this case, because this is just one instance of prosecutorial misconduct or error. Let's go to the second major instance of misconduct and error, and that's Doyle error. It's a clear case of Doyle error. I point the court to EOR, Doyle error, meaning that the prosecutor commented on Mr. Green's constitutional right to remain silent. If you look at pages 346 and 347 of the excerpt of record, the prosecutor asked Mr. Green why he did not tell law enforcement his exculpatory version of the events, why he did not deny ownership of the firearm.
We had a little problem in finding out when the Miranda warning was administered in this case and whether those comments preceded or didn't precede the Miranda warning.
Your Honor, and that is definitive. We know the answer to that question, and the government knew all along when they filed their, I would say, misleading answering brief. If you look at the end of my reply brief, I submitted as an addendum the police report in this case. I also filed that with a motion to supplement the records that it is indeed the government that put this question into issue. In that police report, it says we took him into custody. We read him his Miranda rights. We began to ask him questions.
Is this on Addendum 1?
Addendum of the reply brief, yes. Addendum pages 1 and 2. The substance, the relevant substance, begins on page 2.
Whereabouts?
First full paragraph talks about after being taken into custody, this investigation occurred. Second full paragraph, hearing Green was Mirandized by myself via department-issued card. There's a statement. Okay. He understood. He stated, they asked him if there are any firearms in the house. He stated no, and we assist officers no further.
And what assist no further? Okay.
It's in the reply brief, the addendum. It's the police report.
So the Miranda warning was given prior to the comment on his silence.
Well, that's an interesting issue.
Well, just answer the question. Was it given prior to the comment on his silence?
Your Honor, it was issued prior to any custodial questions. The only wrinkle, what the government raises in their answering brief is this idea that Mr. Green was supposed to spontaneously utter exculpatory statements before he was questioned, which is, not only would that completely eviscerate the whole Doyle line of cases, but it's nonsensical. And nobody puts that onus on a defendant. The minute you are taken into custody, you're supposed to just start spontaneously uttering exculpatory statements without any questioning. Here, the government's not arguing that the law enforcement violated Miranda by engaging in questioning without giving him his Miranda rights. And here, what this police report details, that the officers followed the rule under their obligations under the law. Before they asked him questions, they read him Miranda. They read him Miranda. They began to ask him questions.
I'm looking at this report that you cited to us, and I'm having a little hard time putting it in time sequence. Is this all happening on January 30th?
Yes, the day of arrest, Your Honor. It says, you know, he was taken into custody on this domestic violence arrest.
Okay, but then there was a search, right?
Right.
And they found the silver tape on the bathroom on top of the toilet with the 22 caliber rounds. And then it says, Garen Green was Mirandized by myself. When Green was asked if there were any firearms in the house, he stated no and would not assist officers further. Is that... Are we to assume that that question was asked after the Miranda or perhaps before the Miranda?
Well, Your Honor, if it was asked before Miranda, it would be unlawful custodial interrogation.
That's one of the issues here.
Well, the reasonable supposition to raise here is that it was asked after Miranda. I mean, contemporaneously it says we Mirandized and then we asked.
All right.
Is what it says.
Okay. We'll accept it that way.
Your Honor, just the idea that in the government's answering brief that there is somehow my client is under some obligation to answer questions that aren't answered and that aren't asked. It makes no sense at all. And there is nothing in the case law that puts any onus on a defendant to make spontaneous statements of innocence. And what's also interesting about the Doyle error here, and if you look at it, it is pervasive. We're not talking about one casual question. If you look at pages 346 to 347, there a question is asked, why didn't you immediately tell the officers that's not my gun? And which the Garen Green basically has to admit on the stand that he exercises his right to remain silent, which is on 347, where he says, I didn't say anything. And then it goes on page 352, we have three separate questions on one page, all in violation of Doyle. I mean, this is pervasive Doyle error. And we're talking about a credibility of a witness that's being attacked here through unconstitutional means, whom the government admits is a crucial witness in this case. If the jury believes Garen Green, they acquit. Well, the prosecutor doesn't let the jury believe Garen Green by impeaching his testimony and credibility through unconstitutional means. And this is not a rule that's new in the area of criminal law. This is Doyle error has been around for almost 30 years.
Counsel, I've got to go back to this document. I have a note that this document is not part of the record. Is that
true? That's true. That is true. I filed it with a motion to supplement the record. When I filed my reply brief, it was filed contemporaneously with a motion to supplement the record. And the motions panel or whoever looked at the motion said it would be decided by the panel that decides the case.
But was this in front of the district court?
No, the police report itself.
We supplement the record if the district court didn't have it?
Well, the Doyle error was not raised either. It's a plain error issue, which is part of the reason why there's this lack of...
Yeah, but you're asking us to take into account a document that you say should be made part of the record, but was never part of the record before the district court.
My argument is that Mr. Green was asked about why he did not make exculpatory statements to the police. And the government, in their answering brief, implies that he was never read Miranda rights and that I can't prove that his Miranda rights are read to him and therefore I can't show Doyle error. When the government has in its possession the document that shows that he was read Miranda rights and that he exercised those rights. Now, the government has an obligation, a constitutional obligation, not to ask questions that violate the Doyle rule. They have an onus, an ethical onus, and a legal onus not to do that. The government knew full well he was asked Miranda questions, or they should have known if they read their own documents, that he was read his Miranda rights and exercised them. They come and argue to this court in their answering brief that I can't prove that he was. And I'm telling the court that in reality he was. This is the police report that proves it, and I did ask the supplemental record because it's the government that's putting this issue into play when they, in fact, know the true answer. Now, this court will decide whether it's going to take cognizance of that document. That is my position as to why cognizance should be taken. Okay. The questions themselves are highly questionable, and a prosecutor should have known that what he was asking was improper, and he shouldn't be able to hide behind the fact that there's this dearth of evidence in the record to prove that what they did was unconstitutional when, in fact, they know that it was. So we have the vouching, we have the Doyle error. That's not all, though. We go on to issue number three, the 9/11 transcript. The government introduces this transcript of Garen Green's call to the police, highly prejudicial information about domestic violence allegations. That 9/11 transcript does not meet any hearsay exception. It is pure and simple, inadmissible. It's not a present sense impression because she's detailing an incident that happened 12 hours or at least a few hours before she called.
Was there an objection on grounds
yes.
that it was hearsay?
There was an objection that it was inadmissible hearsay that Shana came in. In fact, there was a lot of argument with the court. The court originally said it wasn't coming in but then let it in on rebuttal. And there was a lot of argument with the court over whether it was a prior consistent statement. And then the court held that it didn't believe it was and wasn't going to let it in, but then it let it in on rebuttal. And we're not. The district court didn't precisely articulate what hearsay exception it thought applied.
Now, we have some cases that allow this sort of thing in on the theory that it's necessary to give some context to what was going on. What's wrong with that?
Well, we go into my last assignment of error, which is that this trial was really a domestic violence trial. And I would concede, and we've always conceded, that the government had a right to put in some information about why the police went to this residence, why they were called there, and then what happened when they arrived there. This case is not one or two fields afar from that. It's eight or nine. If you read this transcript objectively, it is a systematic, constant attempt from the government to interject every single prejudicial information they can about this domestic violence. And I do not exaggerate. This is not hyperbole. It is in this transcript. Every time this prosecutor had an opportunity, he brought out every nauseating deal about this domestic violence. This jury heard over and over and over again about these allegations. They heard it from the two officers as to why they went to the residence, the first two officers who testified. They heard about it from Gloria Green as to what happened in nauseating detail. They heard about it on cross-examination of our witnesses. They did not need this 9/11 transcript. It was purely cumulative. It did not add anything to the case other than to further prejudice my client, and it is not admissible under any articulable hearsay exception, which Bemis, this court's decision in Bemis, says it must be, fall within a hearsay exception, and often it does. It's often a present sense impression or an excited utterance. In this case, it is neither. In fact, the court on page 404, on page 382 of the excerpt of a record, says specifically after listening to the tape, well, you can hear that she's not emotional. But it's not an excited utterance. There's no emotion or that excitement of the event occurring in her voice. Not excited utterance, not a present sense impression, not a prior consistent statement. It's not admissible. In the government's other theory of state of mind, I'm not really sure that's not an articulated hearsay exception in the federal rules of evidence. If there is an exception for then existing emotional condition, but that's not what this transcript talks about at all. It's a narration of events. And the government, in their closing argument, relies on that transcript and says, look at the transcript that shows that our witness is credible. So they're arguing to the jury that it's admissible as, I guess, a prior consistent statement when the court ordered ruled it wasn't. It's filled with highly prejudicial information. If you want to read the transcript, it's in the supplemental excerpt of record. The next issue is the Crawford issue. We have Gabriel Green, an 11-year-old, a daughter of my client, who was available for testimony, who we know in the record, because the government says, well, we just don't want to call her because we're reluctant to do it. And why they're reluctant to call her, we don't know. It wasn't a case where she's not available. She was available to testify.
What do you say to the point that in Crawford that was testimony given at a preliminary hearing, I believe, and they characterize it as testimonial? Do you think a police report qualifies as testimonial?
Your Honor, in Crawford, they give a definition of what they consider a testimonial statement to be or what Scalia considers a testimonial statement. We're not going to define it precisely, but it includes. And in Crawford, they say it includes statements given to police in response to investigation. Voluntary statements would fall within Crawford's definition of a testimonial statement.
Well, given to police in answer to questions, but for aught we know, the child was just sat down, given the form, and told to complete it. Is that questioning by the police? It certainly isn't any leading questions, the kind that might want to be obviated by the Crawford rule, is it?
Well, that the Crawford, the definition of testimonial as explained in Crawford appears to encompass any voluntary statements made to police in conjunction with an investigation. In the language, if I remember right, it's exactly an enumerated example of what a testimonial statement would be. So our position would be we're on firm ground stating that this is a testimonial statement based on the language of the Crawford holding and opinion. The government's best response, and it's not a bad response here, is that our client opened the door to this by saying she didn't write it, which immediately was a stupid thing for my client to say. But the way you get her, what the government should have done with that is what they did, which is to call the officer and say, no, she didn't write it. I know she did write it. I didn't write it. I witnessed her writing. And if that wasn't good enough for him, you call the witness. You don't put in her hearsay statement to prove something, so the jury can. And how do you look at this? And the government's theory is, you can look at the statement and know that an 11-year-old wrote it. How do you do that? I've seen adults whose handwriting is as bad as any 11-year-old. There's no way you can look at a statement and say, well, this was written by an 11-year-old.
As to the content of the statement.
The content of the statement is very prejudicial.
And it's a statement made not under oath, not subject to cross-examination, and introduced for the purpose of proving the truth of the matter asserted, right?
The government's theory is that it was introduced only to show that she didn't write the statement.
Could that not have been done by deleting everything but the signature line and date line?
That would have been a reason.
Was any such motion made by the defendant?
We objected strenuously to its introduction. We did not come up with that specific idea, and that's a great idea.
No motion to redact.
We did not think of that. I will, and that's it. That would have been a great idea, actually, what to do with that statement. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
You may do so, counsel. That's fine. Mr. LaHood.
Good morning. My name is Darren LaHood. I work as an assistant United States attorney in the District of Nevada in Las Vegas. I want to make two brief points, then I'll immediately address the vouching issue. The defendant's entire case at trial was premised on the visceral attack of Gloria Green's untruthfulness and also the officer's untruthfulness. Essentially, Gloria Green committed perjury when she took the stand, and also at least one of the officers committed perjury on the stand. Second point is the overwhelming evidence in this particular trial was that the defendant was guilty of this charge. The jury deliberated less than 2 hours. We had 5 impartial law enforcement officers that testified consistently and contemporaneously with Gloria Green, Steve Kennedy, and Joe Maranzano, 3 civilian witnesses. We have the uncontradicted testimony of Joe Maranzano that less than an hour after the defendant's arrested, they retrieved the gun 2 blocks away from him, the same gun that he gave to Joe Maranzano 2 days before. We have the uncontradicted testimony of Steve Kennedy that was his gun, that it showed up at Mr. Green's house a month before by an employee of his, Cliff. We have Gloria Green's testimony that gun and those bullets were the defendant's bullets.
Pardon me. Did Kennedy testify that the gun showed up at Green's house?
Mr. Kennedy testified that
his gun.
That it was his gun. He recognized that gun in the courtroom. He theorized that gun arrived at that residence a month before when he came over there to see Mr. Green and his wife, along with his wife, Mr. Kennedy's wife, and Cliff was there acting suspicious. He went and looked for the gun. At some point after that, the gun was gone. He theorized that gun that he recognized in court arrived there at Mr. Green's house the night Cliff was there. And that's what he testified to.
He didn't see the gun on Cliff nor at Green's house.
He did not on that particular night. He came up with that theory at trial, Your Honor, and testified to that.
If the evidence was so overwhelming, as you state it to be, and you have so many witnesses to prove, and it was open and shut, why did you need all this vouching, and why did you need all this hearsay?
Well, I'll address the vouching specifically, Your Honor. First of all, the main case that the defense relies on, the Combs case, which recently came down, is completely factually different from this particular case. In that particular case, there was no direct credibility problems with any of the witnesses there. And in that case, if you look at the record there, the prosecutor in that case put on the, while the defendant was on the stand on cross-examination, made him admit that the agent was lying. But that's not all that happened. The district court judge interjected on cross-examination and asked the defendant to admit the agent was lying. The prosecutor then used, by opening his own door, used that admission that, in fact, the defendant testified the agent was lying, and in cross-examination commented on that. The other factual distinction from Combs is the evidence was not overwhelming in that case. It was a very, very circumstantial case. The jury was out at least 3 days in that case. Very circumstantial, completely different from the facts here. And if you read the opinion in Combs and what they talk about, the prosecutor opening his own door, going after and making the defendant admit that the agent lied, that's why it was vouching, commenting in the end. I think this would be a different case, Your Honor, if they had not gone after and done the visceral attack on Gloria Green and the other witnesses. If they had not gone after their untruthfulness, I think this would have been vouching. But, Your Honor, you've got to think about this. Gloria Green was called a pathological liar. She was accused of forgery, which is a felony. She was accused of lying in a court document regarding a restraining order. She was accused of having an affair on her husband with Joe Maranzano. No proof of any of this was presented.
Does that justify vouching?
Your Honor,
did you try the case?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
Does allegations which you consider to be outrageous, does that allow a AUSA to vouch that his witnesses are correct and truthful and the defendant's witnesses are lying?
Your Honor, I think there's an appropriate response, and I think there's a line that can be crossed, and I don't believe it was crossed here, Your Honor. I think if you look at
if defense counsel crosses the line, does that allow vouching, though? I've never heard that concept.
Well, I think there's a concept of riding the scale and invited reply, and I think there's a whole line of cases that go through what a prosecutor can do in inviting reply.
Invited reply never included vouching. There's no such case.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that if you look at the line of cases that we cite in our brief, I don't think the government crossed the line here. This was a different factual scenario when you look at the visceral attack on the witnesses here. To say that the Gloria Green committed perjury, that the officer committed perjury, had to be appropriately responded to.
By saying that you personally don't believe the defense witnesses but believe the government witnesses, is that the appropriate response?
Your Honor, I believe that it didn't cross the line here. I think there's an appropriate, I didn't say the United States government believes she's telling the truth.
Said that you did.
Well, Your Honor.
Did you represent the United States government?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
So isn't that the same thing as saying the United States believes that its witnesses are truthful and the defense witnesses are lying?
Well, Your Honor, I think when you look at those rare cases when vouching has been affirmed or where vouching has been looked at in court cases, it doesn't rise to that level, Your Honor. I mean, those are cases where there's circumstantial evidence or when the truthfulness of witnesses haven't been attacked. And that's completely different in this case, Your Honor. That simply is not the facts here. And I would also argue, Your Honor, that the judge told the jury beforehand and during jury instructions, these are just simply arguments of the witnesses, arguments of the lawyers, and that's what they should be referred to. They also gave jury instructions telling the jurors that these other acts that occurred here, he's not on trial for those acts. And so the judge, I believe, did the appropriate thing in the jury instructions in informing the jurors that these were simply arguments by counsel and not evidence to be believed.
You know, maybe if you didn't have all this vouching and all this alleged error, maybe the jury wouldn't have been out for only 2 hours. It seems to be out of close case. It's his word against her word. He had a credibility. The gun wasn't even found in his premises. It was found somewhere else. And he had a story. You can believe it or not believe it, that his wife is framing him because she's having a love affair with someone else or whatever it was. But it's his word against her word. I didn't see it as a overwhelming case.
Well, you're
short as an overwhelming case that he was, from the government's point of view, that he was a wife beater and a child beater.
Well, Your Honor, I think I would believe you if we didn't have Joe Maranzano and Steve Kennedy testify. We have Joe Maranzano, who lives two blocks away, said 2 days ago he brought me that gun. He brought it in this particular case and gave me that gun and traded me that gun. That's his testimony. That was uncontradicted. So for a jury to be out less than 2 hours, I think is completely appropriate when his testimony is completely consistent with Gloria Green's, with all the officers, and with the statement that came in, and also Mr. Kennedy's testimony. All of those are consistent. I think if it was just her versus him, Your Honor, it would be a closer call. But that's not the facts here. We had a plethora of witnesses that testified consistently and contemporaneously to what Ms. Green testified to, Your Honor. And that was the evidence that was presented to this jury and why they were out such a short period of time.
Mr. Hood, I have another area I'd like to ask you about.
Yes, sir.
You said, if I believe, if I got you correctly, that there was some need to explain domestic violence to show why the police officers were there in the first place. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Now, once there was some mention we were answering a domestic violence report, why is there the need to put in any further testimony as to the substance of the domestic violence dispute?
It's a good question, Your Honor.
Thank you.
This jury cannot hear this case in a vacuum. There's a number of different facts here. The jury is going to wonder why Gloria Green taped these bullets under a bathroom sink. Why
did she? What's your view?
Well, my view, and I think it came out from the evidence, is as she testified, this was the final straw. She had had enough. She had been able to calm him down before, but this went over the line. And on that morning, he asked for the bullets. After the previous evening when the incident occurred and in the middle of the night, he hit her in her bed. She got scared when he asked, "Where's the bullets at?" She took the initiative to grab those bullets where they're at because she was scared without him knowing and hide them in the bathroom area. A jury would want to know why was she doing that? That has to be known.
Why was she scared of the bullets?
Because she didn't know where the gun was at the time. She didn't want him to find that gun wherever it was at. She didn't know where it was at that time. She theorized later it may be at Joe's house. It may still be in the house where he hid it.
She in fear of his using the gun against her? Is that what you're suggesting?
I think that what went through her mind is those bullets belong to a gun. I don't know where that gun is. My daughter or myself could be placed in jeopardy if he's asking for that. She
testified that she didn't know where the gun was in view of the testimony of Maranzano, that the gun was traded for what, for some toys?
For a pool.
For a pool, right? So she knew that she did she also know that didn't know where the pool came from?
That didn't come up in the trial, Your Honor.
Where is the evidence that she didn't know where the gun was? Because if she did know that the gun had been traded to Maranzano, then there's no purpose. There's no way that she could be afraid of the bullets.
Well, if you remember her testimony, Your Honor, when the police immediately got there and asked her, are there any weapons, she said, yes, I think there are weapons in there. There may be a gun. When they didn't find a gun, they went back to her and said, we never found the gun. Where is the gun? And she said, well, you may want to check. He may have traded it to Joe Maranzano. So she came up with that after she thought through the process that I remember him going down there a few days ago. So that's one issue that needed to be addressed in the jury needed to hear.
So she has some doubt whether the gun was in the house, because she told the police officers before Mr. Green said anything that she thought the gun was at Maranzano's, right?
She
the bullets at that point, when she put them under the taped them under the table, were totally innocuous to her.
Well, but she said there
no gun there.
Well, she said there may be weapons in that house.
Well, what weapons? What weapons?
Well. Weapons.
It had to be a 22 gun in order to shoot the 22 bullets, right?
I mean, they were looking for a weapon. They were looking for a gun when they went in there.
Weapons other than the rifle did she have knowledge or fear of?
That was it. Was the rifle, Your Honor.
Then weapons to one side. Weapon. 22 rifle, right?
That was the only thing
she volunteered to the police officers when they asked, we can't find the weapon, that it may be at Maranzano's because it had been traded for a pool. Now you're telling me that she was really worried that the bullets were going to be used to shoot her with a weapon that was at Maranzano's?
Well, Your Honor, I think if you look at her testimony in the cross-examination, it didn't play out exactly like that.
Well, because there may be some belief that she wasn't telling exactly precisely the truth.
Well, getting back to your original point, Your Honor, I think the jury needs to find out why those bullets were there. And also, regarding the need for other testimony regarding this incident and how it was inextricably intertwined, she apparently had this gun and bullets in her house a month before. The jury's going to wonder, why didn't you call police on your husband? That bullet and those guns were in your house a month before when they were brought in there. Why didn't you call police? Well, she waited to call police till this incident. It's not like she called police on the evening of the 29th. She called on the 30th after.
Why should she call the police on her husband?
Why did she?
No, why should she call the police? You're saying that she knew that it was a felony to have ammunition if he was a prior felon?
Well, and the defense went asked her why you didn't call police. And so I think the jury needs to hear why she called police on that day. She called because of the domestic violence right. incident.
And what was the reason why it was necessary to bring in the textual testimony of the child's statement?
Well, Your Honor, that gets to when he took the stand 11 different times, he said that statement was not written by my daughter. I swear on my mother's grave, was his quote, that officer lied.
Did you have any comparison writings that were authenticated by the child that were submitted to the jury so that they could make a lay opinion as to the comparability of the writing?
No, Your Honor.
Well, did you have an expert witness who testified that in his opinion, after being duly qualified, the writing on this piece of paper was that of the daughter?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I would further add on that the defendant went through a lengthy analysis of why this was not his daughter's statement, and he really opened the door to this particular statement. And but for his statements, that handwritten statement of the daughter would have never came in. It would have never been brought in if he hadn't taken the stand and said, that officer's lying, that's not my daughter's handwriting.
Could you prove the authenticity of the statement being made by the daughter by showing the signature line and the date? Without the text.
Well, Your Honor, if that would have been recommended, I think that would have been appropriate, Your Honor, at that time.
So, you know, sometimes we use hindsight, which isn't really fair.
And I think in hindsight, I think if that recommendation had been put forth, I think that would have been appropriate, Your Honor.
Yeah, but without it being recommended, what you put in was pure hearsay. You put in information which showed that the man's a wife and child beater. And, you know, you could say that they convicted him for being a wife beater and let the possession by a felon go by the board.
Well, I would also add, when that was admitted, the judge gave a limited instruction on that, saying this is strictly limited for the purpose, not of the truth of matter asserted, but strictly to show the daughter wrote this, and admonished that jury specifically on that point.
The judge told the jury to forget about the white elephant in the jury room. I understand.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that was the statement. So it wasn't only that it went to prove the officer didn't lie and that this was not falsified and the officer committed perjury, that in fact this was, you know, handwritten by the daughter, Your Honor. I would also add, Your Honor, in looking at the overwhelming amount of evidence that was present in this case, I would also add when the defendant took the stand, the government intended to bring up his prior 5 felony convictions. And the judge, in an abundance of caution, restricted us. We couldn't even bring in the fact that a month early he'd been convicted of the same exact charge, being a felon in possession of a firearm, which we argued adamantly that should be brought in. But the judge, in abundance of caution, said that's too prejudicial.
You're not the appellant. The defendant is the appellant.
I'm just saying that goes to the point that the evidence was overwhelming in this case, and I believe that's why the judge didn't do it. He didn't allow. He handcuffed the government because the evidence was overwhelming in this case, Your Honor.
The evidence was so overwhelming. Why didn't you try the case like a choir boy and just let the jury call the shots instead of all this error and this vouching? You know, you didn't have to cross the Rubicon here with any hearsay or vouching if it was so overwhelming.
Well, Your Honor, again, when someone's called a pathological liar and when someone is accused of forgery, which is a felony, and accused of perjury in another state of court appearance, accused of cheating on her husband, accused of framing the defendant, planting the gun and bullets on the defendant. I mean, these were all attacks by the defendant. All of these things. They needed to be responded to appropriately. And I agree with you, Judge. If none of this had been brought up regarding the untruthfulness and the visceral attack on her, it would have been vouching. but it had to be appropriately responded to. And when you look at the Combs case, which is their number one case, it in no way is factually similar to the facts here, Your Honor. If there are no other questions at this time.
No questions, counsel.
Thank you.
You have some reserve time.
It's interesting the government would come up and say in Combs that the prosecutor was so out of line because he tried to get the defendant to admit that a cop was lying. If you look at page 349 of our ER, government cross-examination of Garen Green says, question by the prosecutor, so if Detective Sanborn had that in his report, he'd be lying. Defense counsel objection, that's an improper question. The court sustains the objection. So the only reason why the government didn't get away with that tactic in this case is because the court sustained that objection. They're hardly on the high ground in this case. And in Combs, specifically addresses this invited response argument that the government keeps making. They keep talking about Combs, but they didn't look at the case because the case there says that there is no invited error exception. You cannot vouch for witnesses, period. Invited error may have some relevance when we evaluate these statements for whether they're prejudicial or not, but certainly defense counsel can attack the credibility of witnesses. And that gets back to how strong was this evidence? This is a unique case where under even the government's theory of conviction, Mr. Green voluntarily relinquished the weapon days before his arrest. This is not a case, even under their theory, if you assume all their facts are true, he did not possess this weapon on the day of his arrest. Under their theory, he gave it away. And he gave it away to a man, allegedly, who was having an affair, allegedly, with Gloria Green.
But how is that relevant? The indictment says on or about November 28th. It doesn't say at the time of the arrest. You can prove that if he had it 3 days before, he was a felon then, and he had possession of the gun then.
A permissible theory of prosecution, but it also is one that points to the weakness of the evidence because it's an unusual theory of prosecution.
Did you object on that particular issue?
No, you're right. There's nothing wrong with that, with them charging it that way. My point is that the fact that he voluntarily relinquished it makes the case unusual and also makes it more difficult to prove. And we're talking about Gloria Green, we're talking about a woman who we learned on cross-examination. Once my client was taken into custody on this charge, she filed a TPO saying, with the court, saying not that I'm afraid of him, but that I want all his assets. And we did put a strong case up there that she was a biased witness and that she may have been having an affair with this Joe Maranzano guy and that they may have, in fact, framed Mr. Green. That was our theory of defense. In order to defeat that theory of defense, the prosecution vouched for their witnesses, engaged in unconstitutional cross-examination, and committed a host of other errors and misconduct that prevented us from receiving a fair trial. This was indeed a closed case. There's clear error. The conviction should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and we will now hear argument in the last case for this docket.